This episode of the Ultimate Predator Podcast is supported by the good folks at Venator Media Solutions, multimedia company focused on hunting in the outdoor community. Whether you need a new logo for your brand, a clever ad campaign to set your company apart, or an editor to tidy up your writing, these guys are among the best in the business. And they're hunters and outdoorsmen themselves, so they get it. Visit their website at www.venatormediasolutions.com. That's V-E-N-A-T-O-R, mediasolutions.com. Drop them a line and tell them we sent you. Venator Media Solutions, amplify your adventure.
Welcome to episode 15 of the Ultimate Predator Podcast. My name's Nate Granzo, TUP's editor-in-chief, and I'm joined by my pal, the founder of the Ultimate Predator, a man so refined he's been known to age cheap scotch as it passes his lips, and he has his own line of smoking jackets, Mr. Carl Hiley. How you doing this week, buddy?
I do not do that. I do not drink cheap scotch.
Not anymore, right?
Never passes my lips.
Well, we've got a fun show planned. I think we're going to talk a little bit about your putting in a food plot, making plans for the fall.
Yeah.
And then we can move on to my argument for why I think solid bullets are one of the less appreciated bullets out there, and how, especially when it comes to hunting big game, they're kind of a do-all option that doesn't get nearly enough love. And then for today's dumb idea poorly executed, we're going to talk a little bit about the wolf reintroduction ballot in Colorado, which should be full of fun. And you've been doing a little bit of research on wolf introduction just broadly, right? Or more like people's infatuation with wolves and how...
Yeah, I read, or I guess in this case listened to an audiobook called American Wolf that was... it was really interesting because, I mean, like, I personally, like, I like wolves. I think they're really cool. But I also think they should be controlled.
Yeah.
Like any other big game animal.
Right,
so
right.
I'm kind of in that middle ground, you know, people... But most people seem to either just... Wolves are the most amazing thing ever, or every wolf in the world needs to die.
Yeah,
it's like one or the other, and so it's interesting. It's an interesting book. It's really interesting. We'll talk about it.
Right, right. We don't have to get into that now, but I think that'll be an interesting conversation. So let's talk a little bit about your food plot that you're putting in. So you went through and the other day you're just starting to clear stuff out. Is that kind of where you're at in the process?
Yeah, yeah. There's some weeds all grown up. A little bit of weeds, a lot of just kind of orchard grass type stuff.
Was this an existing plot that you had used in the past, or are you starting fresh here?
This so is just like... I had kind of made a half-hearted attempt on... So I'm going to put in a couple.
Okay.
And one is going to be brand new. And one is a place where I sort of half-heartedly put in a food plot, you know, where I cut down the grass and the weeds really low, and I raked it up, and I kind of overseeded on it and stuff like that.
Sure.
So I have, you know, there's definitely some clover in there, but not as much as I would have liked out of it.
Okay.
But, so I'm going to redo that, like, properly. So in one of them, yeah, I'll put in like clover and some chicory, and then the other one I'll do, you know, probably some beets or some kind of tuber like that for late season.
Okay. So tubers on the whole tend to be a late season kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you're an archer, you hunt the bow season, you want something that's going to be appealing to deer early in the season. So clover is going to be more of an ongoing.
Yep. Yeah. So the clover will be nice early season, you know, middle of September when the season opens. And then during the rifle season, it'll kind of actually maybe be both depending
okay.
on the weather.
Sure.
Right. So with those tubers, like beets, for example, they don't become really a food source for deer until after the first hard frost.
Okay.
Because with a hard frost, that releases the sugars in the beet. And so now they taste good to deer.
Okay.
Where before they don't taste very good. So
sure.
They don't eat them. So they're a good, you know, later season after that first hard frost.
Gotcha. Okay. Which up here in Minnesota could be middle of September, you know.
Right, or it could be December.
Right, yep.
But the archery season does extend to December 31st.
Okay.
So they'll work great for that.
Sure.
Well. But so, yeah, I was cutting, you know, doing a lot of weed whacking and also cutting down a few kind of smaller trees and stuff like that, doing a little bit of land clearing. Till I threw the chain off my chainsaw. Brand new chainsaw, of course.
That's nice.
And then it was a weird thing where I couldn't get the tensioner to work just right.
Oh, so you're just out of luck then.
Yeah, so it was like if the chain would spin, if I could get the chain to spin, it was a little too loose.
Okay.
You know where I was like, it's going to throw again?
Yep.
But then if I tightened it up a little bit more, then I couldn't get it to spin at all. And so I don't know. It's a brand new saw, so maybe they set it up funky or wrong or who knows, whatever. I'll bring it in and be like, I just bought this one, guys. Come on.
Help me out. Yeah, in my experience, it's whenever you need a tool or whenever you need to get something done, that's when the tool doesn't work. And there's nothing I hate more than having to fix a tool to do a job I already didn't want to do.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's always the way it goes, whether it's mowing the lawn or whatever. It's always like you got to fix the tool first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I have this brand new saw that I've used once for like 30 seconds. And then so I get out there and I mean, I'm not kidding you, within 5 minutes I threw the chain.
Oh, jeez. Now, as far as timing goes, for getting the bow season, you're probably, this is kind of the cusp, isn't it? Like as far as, you know, having a thorough growth in place.
Yeah, I mean, July, I mean, clover grows pretty fast.
Okay.
So I'm probably okay as long as it's not too dry.
And it has been pretty dry up here too, so hopefully we'll get some decent rain.
Yeah, so if it's hot and dry, I might be in a little bit of trouble for the bow season, having the clover ready. But it's a fallow farm field on the other side of the stand, so...
So deer moving around anyway.
There's clover in that, and there's deer moving around out there. But the stand is kind of in a funky place where... They don't really come into great bow range.
Yeah, I suppose in hindsight, where we put that thing in, it's probably a great rifle stand.
Oh, it's perfect. It's perfect. I mean, there's, you know,
good line of sight.
Yeah, I mean, it's 200 yards one way, 200 yards back the other way.
Just far enough where a slug gun's like, a little iffy on the outskirts.
Yeah, but now if they're, because they're talking about removing that restriction, open it back into rifles.
That'd be handy for you. Get that 270.
270, anything. But yeah, so kind of one of my hopes was, you know, get that clover up and growing, so bring them in a little bit closer.
Sure.
You know, they kind of skirt on that edge of range where it's like, you know, they come in that 40-yard range or so.
Sure.
You know, 30 to 50. So it's kind of a, you know, inside of 40 yards, I'm pretty comfortable. But once you get beyond that, it's starting to be like, I could, but should I?
Right, ethically. Yeah, and the tolerance, and speaking completely as someone who hasn't done any bow hunting, but just from what I've observed, the tolerance for anything going wrong when you're bow hunting, it seems like you just don't have any allowance for, like, anything goes wrong in the way that you know, raise up to the release to whatever. And you were talking last year about how you had an arrow that had just a little knock in one of the blades, right? And that made it fly a little funky.
Yeah. From when I was patterning them into a target, it's mechanical blades. So the blades that extend right when it hits they're basically razor blades,
right?
Like thin razor blades, which is on the one hand great because they're really sharp, but they're also pretty fragile. And so shooting into the target, one had gotten nicked.
Okay.
And so it was actually steering the arrow just a little bit, and so I took a shot with it was like a 30-yard shot. It was either 30 or 40 yards. And the deer was quartering. And it actually steered that arrow enough that it hit the deer in the back leg.
Oh, really? But I suppose that that's, you know, even a few feet can make all the difference between a hit to the vitals and a complete pot shot.
Which... Oh, yeah. Well, and I mean, with archery, if you're a difference, in, if you misjudge your distance by 5 yards, you miss the animal completely.
Right. Yeah, you suppose know, once you're out
beyond 35, 40 yards.
Right. Yeah, you just don't have the velocity to make up for the drop in the arrow, right? Right.
Exactly. So, gotcha. So, yeah, I was trying to bring them in a little bit closer because it just turns out the way that the landscape is shaped or laid out, they just kind of go around a little bit.
Or maybe it's time we got to drag that stand over and put it somewhere.
Well, that's the other thing I'm going to do is on the other side of the field, there's a nice little area, which is where I'm going to put that, tuber food plot.
Yeah, just I'll throw a portable up.
Put a stand up in there, and so that'll probably be my archery stand.
Okay.
And then the nice big permanent one that we had put in.
Just switch over for slug season.
Be my rifle over firearm season.
Fingers crossed for rifle, right?
Exactly. Hoping for rifle. I'm going to say that it's going to be rifle, and it's going to happen.
And you haven't heard anything on that front since that kind of got kicked around?
Yeah, I haven't looked recently.
But I mean, with all the chaos that's been going on, I'm sure that's between, far from anybody's...
Between the coronavirus and all the protests and everything. But the Great American Outdoors Act did pass, so who knows?
Right.
Some of that stuff.
Right, that's true.
Is kind of a...
With an overwhelming majority, I think, right? I mean, yeah. It was pretty well received.
Yeah, so some of those... some of the outdoor stuff can be like sort of unifying-ish things where they're like, we can do get something done without, sure. You know, any sort of blowbacks. Like, see, we did stuff.
Well, we'll take it. Don't fire us.
Yeah,
we can do
it.
Things.
We'll take it.
Yeah. Well, good deal. Let's talk a little bit about solid bullets. Now, this is an argument that when I first pitched this to you, you're like...
Convince me, man.
Yeah,
convince
I was going to say, because you have a pretty clear idea of like what works for you. And you have an exact bullet type that you shoot consistently and you're happy with it. This one's a little bit of a tough sell, admittedly. But I do have a couple of people on my side that I think speak volumes. I've got the legends like Karamojo Bell, who we've spoken about on the podcast before, the legendary elephant hunter. Ernest Hemingway was a big advocate of solids. Peter Hathaway Capstick, who we talked about, I think, the last podcast. He spoke pretty extensively about why he always carries solids for shooting big game and dangerous game in Africa.
Okay, so what's the argument here?
The central premise is just that there are bullet types. Everything does something well, and it has drawbacks, right? There's always going to be negatives. But with solids, it has a lot of benefits and few drawbacks. So it's a good baseline bullet for anything from big game to less big game. So if it works on an elephant, okay. Which is the argument.
So is what you're really saying is that solids are the best overall bullet?
That's a bold claim, but yeah, I'm going to make it. What the hell?
That's why I want to be like,
yeah, no,
I feel like you're tiptoeing around it, trying to be, but like, come on, are you saying?
And I think part of that, the reason I'm afraid to just jump right in on this is that I know how passionately people feel about everything from guns to calibers to the bullets themselves. It's like, and everybody's got good reasons for why they prefer a certain bullet. But just from what I've found here and the little bit of research I've done and some of the reading, the appeal of solids in particular over some of these other, because you have jacketed, partition bullets, soft points, bonded, you have like a million different configurations of bullet. The solid is just, it's one unified piece of lead, essentially. Or in some cases, I think you can get them in copper solids, too. Yeah. But, so, the argument that I think makes the most sense to me is that if they work so well on dangerous game, which I think, at least here in the U.S., there's kind of this notion that solids, like, when we carry our bear guns, we load them up with solids, because you want that added penetration to be able to get through that mountain of muscle and fur and whatever to hit the vitals. Mm-hmm. The argument that made the most sense to me about using solids on things that aren't dangerous game is that if they work so well on dangerous game, why wouldn't you also consider using them for not so dangerous game? And We'll get into that because I can already see the look on your face. You're like, I can tell you right now why not. All right, and I get that. The argument is not that this bullet does everything better, because it doesn't. But it does a lot of things really well. Reasons that solids are good. They penetrate really, really well. So the assumption when you're, say, deer hunting, is that you're always going to have this perfect broadside where you have the option to take it right in the boiler room, and it's never going to be a problem. You just want something that hits and expends all its energy, causes massive damage, and that's the end of it right there. You want a one shot and right. Drop. Solids don't expend all their energy because they have that penetration. They don't deliver as much kinetic energy.
It's going to pass through.
It's going to right. Well, and that's the argument.
Expanding bolts pass through a deer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most of the time.
But again, that's the assumption that you're always going to have that perfect broadside. Now, in cases where you don't have a perfect broadside and you shoot something that expands immediately upon impact, it may not make it all the way to the boiler room because it's going to expand or fragment or whatever. Okay. And it may not drive through and deliver the damage that you need or reach the most essential parts.
Okay. So, like, what kind of shot are we talking here? That?
How about a Texas heart shot? The classic favorite, okay. Right up the back end. Or the front, or a quartering away shot where you have to cover more than just...
Man, a quartering away shot, you don't need extra penetration. It's like a perfect right through the soft tissue into the soft tissue.
Fine. All right.
Maybe a quartering into and you got to go through the scap.
Right, through the shoulder. The idea is, fine. Have it your way.
I'm just going to say, I'm not going to take a Texas heart shot.
Right, most people would not. But
I'm not out here like starving. I need that to eat.
Sure. But if you have an option to still get the kill, taking a less than ideal shot, I'll say just generically, vaguely, a less than ideal broadside shot, then this opens up some options as far as added penetration to reach that. Deer may not be the best choice because they do tend to be a smaller animal. No, cut it out with that look. Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly.
Well, I think...
All right, how about elk?
I was going to say, where you can maybe start to get into this argument is elk.
Well, bigger. Right, and that's another point, too, is that the solids are versatile. So, say you're in elk country, and you've got your rifle. There is a potential in some areas that you could run into a grizzly.
Mm-hmm.
A rifle that has a soft point or something that's intended to be frangible is not going to penetrate very well on something that is as heavy duty as a grizzly. It may do the trick, but solids are preferable for big predators like that dangerous game.
Yeah.
So in a case like that, then you're splitting the difference. You have it loaded with something that would work on either one. And again, with elk, you're talking about a bigger bodied animal that, yeah, you may actually have to truck through a little bit more tissue, mm-hmm. more muscle to be able to reach something important. So, you won't always get the broadside shot. They penetrate really deeply. They're versatile, so they could be used in a pinch on dangerous game as well as non-dangerous game. Meat damage is minimized. That one you can't argue with because, yeah, that neat little pinprick you're complaining about, that also means that... And I think one of the points that needs to be acknowledged, too, is that when you're shooting a rifle round, and I think we've spoken about this before, a rifle round moving at high velocity, thousands of feet per second, it's not just causing damage in the path of the bullet, right?
Right.
So you have secondary cavitation that is essentially that force that's entering the tissue is causing damage to the surrounding, the adjacent tissue. And if it nears the vitals, it could even rupture some of the organs because right. they have low tensile strength. Or if a solid hits a bone, that sucker, it's like it fragments, the bone fragments and becomes almost grenade-like. That causes damage too.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing when I saw when I read your article was that the idea that you're essentially turning bone into additional projectiles inside the body.
It's almost doing the frangible aspect of the bullet right. in place of the bullet.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's the appeal of the solid is it holds together and it tends to maintain its form throughout its path. Even if it hits a bone, it may smear, it may deform a little bit, but it's not going to create that same effect that you get with some of these other proprietary rounds that are on the market today. But yeah, the acknowledgments where they're due. With deer hunting, if you know the environment you're in, there's no chance of coming across anything that's going to try to eat you. You're probably going to get a lot better results with a bullet that's designed to expand and deliver the most energy on target quickly.
Yeah. See, that's why I right there, I think you just like contradict your own argument.
Well, no, I'm saying that you have bullets that as long as you're, this is a good baseline do-all. It's a utility yeah. player. He's the guy who you bring in to throw at third base or right field or shortstop or whatever in a pinch. He's not going to be especially good at any of it. He's not your starter, but he can do a whole lot of things fairly well. That's what you're getting with the solids. Karamojo himself said that he found the solid to be very deadly for any kind of game. And an end-on shot with his bullet in the vitals are sure to be raked if the holding is as it should be. So I think the focus with solids is that as long as you're counting on hitting something important, like you're mm-hmm. making a good shot, it doesn't matter that you're using a solid versus, you know, something that,
yeah,
right, because it's going to hit the important parts. Hemingway was saying that you can take a shot from any angle if you know the anatomy of the game, and the solid bullet won't break up, won't expand or slow down. It'll continue straight on its course toward the vital organ that you intend to pierce. But then he also talked about how you have to approach it almost like a surgeon then. And when you're, you know, when you're going through and actually field dressing your game, you should take a look at how the game looks mm-hmm. internally
yeah.
to get a feel for this is where the lungs are, this is where the heart is. Because, and he compared it to being a surgeon with a scalpel. And that's what you'll become with solids, that you have this pinpoint hole that's going to drive through to go right through no matter what. But you have to make sure you know what it is. You can't count on just the force of the damage being adequate if you hit it somewhere in the area.
So this is like where this whole argument becomes like a problem for me.
Okay, let's hear it.
Because I mean, that's like saying, well, you could kill an elk with a 22 if you make a good shot.
Sure.
You know, and so, like, sure. What's the difference, really? Like, yeah, I can do it from more angles, I guess, with a solid bullet than with a 22, but it's kind of like anything will work if you make a good shot, and while it's true that it works best against, like, big, dangerous game because it has so much penetration, with some of this other game, penetration isn't so important because you don't have as much to penetrate through. So now you're like decreasing your efficacy versus an expanding bullet.
Right. And again, I'm not saying that this is a substitute for all bullets. And that's why when you're like, you're basically saying the solid is like the best bullet. I'm not saying that. I'm not. Because again, and especially since technology has come so far, there's some really good stuff that's on the market today. And a lot of it that, again, if you're suiting the cartridge, the caliber to your environment, if you're shooting white-tailed deer in northern Minnesota, no, solids may not be the best choice, right? And because there are very few instances where it's going to excel over what you would get with other
right, bullets. Exactly.
This is saying that as a baseline, it is one of the more versatile more versatile rounds available. It's the simplest. Conceptually, it's the simplest. And it works in a variety of environments. And again, if you're making a good shot, like you said, it kind of cuts both ways. If you make a good shot, it doesn't really matter, right? Right. Well, then as long as you're making a good shot, then it's not going to matter.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what you could say is, like, I mean, I suppose you could say a solid will work on anything.
Right.
Where
There are situations where
maybe wouldn't.
Yeah, there are situations where an expanding bullet may not be ideal, or it may not be as versatile in certain circumstances. But likewise, there are a number of circumstances where a solid is not going to deliver the results that you want either. So it's the onus is on the hunter, obviously, to suit what it is they're shooting to what they're in the quarry and where they're going to be and what they anticipate coming across.
Yeah.
But as just a good utility, and again, this kind of, it threw me a little bit at first too, because I've never subscribed to that either. Like I don't use solids for anything other than Grizzlies, right? In my mm-hmm. handgun.
Mm-hmm.
But it got me thinking about, you know, the logic behind it does make some degree of sense that, you know, these guys who hunted extensively in Africa, they were up against things that were as enormous as an elephant, as deadly and quick as a lion, as soft-skinned as an antelope that's barely the size of a dog. And yet, these guys are saying, you know what? End of the day, I'm going with the solid because it works on all of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that again, that's not dismissing that there are a number of other options out there that may be better for what it is you're doing. But, yeah, just as a good catch-all, I think. And the thing is, in the U.S., solids haven't ever really caught on, like, right. ever.
Yeah.
And other than maybe in hand loaders, I think that people who cast their own bullets, because there are folks that hunt with their own cast bullets, in which case you are hunting with a solid. It's just, you know, a gas-checked solid lead bullet.
Right.
Nothing fancy, but there are a number of people that do that. But as far as, like, on the market, if you were to go shop at, you know, Cabela's or whatever, and you walk down the reloading aisle, the majority of what you're going to see are the partition type bullets, the, you know, bonded, whatever.
Yeah, when you walk down the ammo aisle, you won't see anything but that.
Exactly. Right. That's true. Yeah. If you're just buying factory rounds, you'd be really hard pressed to find anything other than that. But, so yeah, I don't think it's much of a concern here. And I think that's part of it is that we have a lot less dangerous game here. But this, the argument is that you could use it and it would work fine. May not work better than everything else, but it would work fine.
Man, I was hoping you were going to be more like controversial.
Really dig my heels in.
Yeah, take just a like, real no, inflammatory you know, position.
Well, part of it is that, again, I don't believe it. You know, like I'm not the first out there to say that this is the end all be all, but yeah, it's always interesting to read about some of these old hunters that have a lot of field experience because I think a lot has changed in hunting, but also there's a lot that has really stayed true for, you know, really a century or more. You know, a lot of the techniques and even some of the technology, it's not that dramatically different over what was used, you know, back in the 50s, for instance. So it's always interesting to kind of get a little take on, you know, what some of the older generation used and why they valued that versus what's available to us today.
Yeah.
And just compare and contrast and see just how much benefit we're getting from some of the technology and stuff that we have at our disposal, of which there's a lot. I mean, laser rangefinders, I don't think anybody back then was, yeah, it was all Kentucky windage. It looks about 300 yards, a little wind coming out of the south. Yeah, so times have definitely changed, technology's changed, but solid bullets, They prevail. They just stay the same. Yeah, sorry, I didn't give you much of an argument there, but I hate to break this to you, but you're like the least fun person to argue with because you're really good at it. So like I could come into an argument like I've got this figured out. I've got all my arguments. I've got every detail already figured out, and then you'll like, yeah, but what about this? And I'll go, I didn't study for this. I didn't have that one written down. Wasn't prepared for that.
I did almost go to law school.
You would have done fine. You would have done really well. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so that's my take on solids. I don't know. Your mileage may vary. I think there are a lot of proponents of them, like I said, in the hand loader crowd especially, that it is fun to be able to cast your own stuff, too. I mean, it's certainly cheap. I don't know if you want to go cheap as far as hunting goes, but like for just plinking and stuff,
yeah.
Cast bullets are great because, you know, like at one point I think we were doing that with nines, weren't we?
Yeah, your dad was doing that with
nines and 45s. Nines and
45s.
Yeah. He's
loading up the 45 long Colts for those vaqueros.
Yeah, for the cowboy action stuff. But the 9mm, I think we got it because we had kept brass forever. We had buckets of brass from, you know, we've been shooting since high school. And at the time, it was kind of laughable because nobody reloaded nines. You know, you could go down to a store and buy a box for $8
or
$7 or whatever. And so why would you keep the brass for that? You know, you can't even reload them that cheap.
Right.
Well, then things got expensive. And right. We took care of the cost of the bullets by casting our own out of scrap lead.
Yep.
And then we already had the brass, or it was just primer and powder. I think we got it down to where it's just like a few cents a round.
Yeah.
I mean, that's tough to beat as far as just plinking rounds go. That's pretty awesome. So. Yeah,
as long as your semi-auto loader doesn't start smashing the nose of that soft bullet and deforming it.
Yeah, because then you're not going to have much luck loading it, that's for sure. No, that's
one
true.
One of your dad's guns had that issue. I remember with the nines.
Yeah, just with the feed ramp where it's just aggressive. It would catch on the edge every time.
It would like put an indent in it, so then it wouldn't load all the way into battery. Right. And
that's another weird thing is like adding, I think they add nickel to lead to try to adjust the hardness. And so getting the right hardness of lead matters too, because if it's too soft, it just smears.
Right.
And you end up with a leaded up barrel in like a few shots, you know, and then it's just a mess. But you also don't want it so hard that you're, you know, not getting the desired results. So it's kind of walking that fine line. There's a lot of weird science that goes into that. Not to mention the fact that lead is like super deadly. So you got to be, you know, when you're melting it, you don't exactly want to be standing in the closed room with it. So
in those fumes.
Yeah, not great. But anyway, all right, let's move on because I think we've beaten that solid bullet thing down. You've made me feel wholly inadequate, ill prepared for this.
To be fair, so there is a really good point on that. It's versatile. It will work for anything.
Right.
So there's something to be said for that.
But that's pretty much where it ends. I mean,
yeah.
I get that. I do. It's like if you have the option, there's going to be better choices most of the time.
Exactly.
But I get, especially for if you were a guide and your responsibility was to take down either a wounded animal or a really pissed off animal because your charge put a bad shot on it. I would want the do-all for that. For sure.
Oh, yeah.
Because then it's like, well, you know, in any case, whatever the situation is, you got something that's going to work. And those guys obviously shot enough where they were
going to hit where they want to hit.
Yeah. It's less about, well, I hope I have the right shot to get the. It's more like, I just need to make sure the bullet goes where it needs to go once I deliver it. So, so I get it, especially from their perspective, where some of these legit big game hunters are big proponents of it, whereas the rest of us are like, yeah, I don't know how much does that apply to me so much?
Right.
So yeah, I think that's fair. But anyway, let's move on. The wolf reintroduction in Colorado is kind of an interesting deal because it seems like, at least at first blush, just kind of reading about this, it seems like people that are both proponents of the reintroduction and those who are against it, neither one have very good arguments about it. Like, or at least maybe they just aren't articulating it that well, but it seems like there's a lot of emotion wrapped up in this and not enough, like, just cold analysis.
Yeah, man. Wolves and grizzly bears just make people lose their minds.
And that's bizarre. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is? Is it all the stories like, you know, the teddy bears and wolves kind of look like dogs? I mean, is there something there that kind of speaks to that?
Oh, man, I don't know. It's just like, They're really charismatic and wild and
sure. Oh, maybe that's it. They embody, you know, the quintessential wild animal, right? Yeah. Like when you think of like the Wild West, the dances with wolves. You know, they're not dances with coyotes. Yeah. They're not dances with a raccoon.
Yeah, and there's so much kind of pop culture literature around them.
Sure.
You know, and for so long, right, humans have had such an interesting relationship with these animals, right? So our, in some sense, like our lives revolved around these animals in sort of an adversarial sense, right?
Right.
You know, they were competition to hunter-gatherers.
Yep.
Right, and so you hear, there's all these phrases, you know, like he's a lone wolf.
Sure.
Right, there's just so much contemporary vernacular and literature, and they apply, you know, this language of these to people, and I don't know. I'm spitballing, man. I'm trying to figure it out.
So it's almost like, so it's less about like, oh, it looks like my pet, and more like it almost anthropomorphizes into like they have human qualities that they admire or something. I mean,
so there is, I think, both.
Okay.
I think your average New Jersey cat lady is like, oh, it looks like a dog.
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
But then there are people, I mean, they full on anthropomorphize wolves, right? So this book that I listened to, American Wolf, is about... I both loved the book and hated it. It had amazing stories about wolves.
Okay.
Like, wolves are cool, and their interactions are cool.
Yeah.
They're just like, they're cool to hear about, they're cool to watch.
For sure. There's nothing more chilling than middle of the night laying in your tent and hearing them howl, you know? That's, although in my experience, it usually sounds like a dog and they're just barking, because they do that too. Yeah. They sound like dogs out there, but anyway, sorry.
So, because the stories about the wolves were just first rate, okay? But then there was also like a biography, basically, alongside it, of this wolf watcher guy in Yellowstone. He was kind of like the wolf watching guy.
Okay.
Right? So, I mean, all the wolf studies that go on in Yellowstone after the reintroduction, I mean, they're tracking these wolves like crazy.
Sure.
Every morning they're out there. I mean, this guy, at one point, he had gone like 800 and some days in a row seeing a wolf.
Wow. That's a little fanatical.
Oh, yeah. Crazy. But it was to the point where these wolves were like his family.
Okay.
You know, like he watches them so much and studies them so much that, you know, he knows their habits.
Probably recognized individual wolves. And
exactly. That's their name.
That's Joe Bob.
You know, they're named.
Right.
Oh, there's so-and-so with her new pups. She's now the alpha. She had a fight with her sister to become the alpha.
It's a soap opera.
Her sister went off to this other...
That's what it is. He's out there watching a nature's own soap opera.
Yeah, and it really kind of is. And they really do apply... They start to apply human thoughts to why wolves do this, that, or the other thing.
Okay.
You know, and they really believe that they understand why a wolf did something.
Right.
Because that's how a human would think about it. And then it got kind of juxtaposed with, it started to get really political.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can't, well, you can't, but to take a complete picture of, like, what's gone on in Yellowstone and, you know, Montana and Wyoming and wolves and Idaho, you do have to take some of the politics into consideration and, like, hunting and how ranchers and the cattle industry, the ag industry has had a say in all of that. And so it was fair for them to talk about it, but they didn't stick to just this and this happened. And then this happened, and there was this happened, so that happened.
It wasn't objective
reporting.
They
started making value judgments or value statements about things that in the end really like kind of painted hunters and the ag industry as like the evildoers.
Sure.
And so I loved the book and hated it at the same time because the stories were really cool, but it was just too political in a way that sort of attacked people like me.
Right.
I didn't feel like it did a fair job of trying to understand our side.
Right.
Anyway. But yeah, man, people, they really anthropomorphize wolves to a crazy extent. And so like when a wolf that this guy, you know, had been watching for since she was a pup.
Right.
He watched this wolf get born, collared this wolf, watched this wolf for whatever, 7 years or however long, and then, you know, when that wolf got shot by a hunter,
he takes that very personally.
Yeah absolutely. And so they're invested against hunting because, well, now it's like they're hunting their pet or their family member.
Sure.
And not a wild animal.
Right.
So, man, wolves make people go crazy. And the same thing, you know, ranchers can be just on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's every wolf is just this killer.
Killing machine.
All they do is go around and kill everything. And they all need to die, you know?
Right.
And
That was, and the truth is probably somewhere in between, as it always is.
Yeah, and you know, and they're so against wolves that then they just start saying just mind-bogglingly crazy stuff like this. Back to the Colorado.
Right, right. Yeah, we never actually spoke about the Colorado thing specifically. Although a lot of what we've talked about so far applies.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like the, what is he? He's one of the ranchers, Colorado cattleman vice president.
Okay.
He went in and he said, Colorado is not appropriate wolf habitat.
Well, that's just patently untrue.
Right, it's just a silly statement.
Well, yeah, I mean, naturally, wolves were there prior to this whole thing kicking off,
yeah,
right?
And they're starting to come back on their own.
Right, which is where the other end of the argument gets a little ridiculous. This the insistence that if they don't...
Yeah, let's back up a second, what's going on
right in Colorado? Well, as far as I can tell, essentially this effort to reintroduce wolves was brought up. They want to push it through to the ballot. They want to have it voted on. And something happened with the COVID thing where they kind of had to abbreviate the session, and so it got pushed back. But that just brings it to the forefront now where it's starting to be reevaluated, I think, just in recent weeks. And so it's back to the same arguments from both sides that some say that it has to be, that it's the only means for wolves to make a comeback is through this reintroduction, mm-hmm. which I would argue is clearly false because they are beginning to come back. And they even acknowledge that wolves are beginning to expand their range and are starting to make their way. There are numerous sightings in Colorado.
Yeah.
But yeah, you have the party on the one hand that's arguing that this reintroduction is vital and necessary. And the other half that's saying that this is, like you had said, that wolves are unnatural to Colorado, which is also not true, because clearly wolves were, at one point, naturally endemic to that area.
Yeah.
And now they're starting to come back. So I think, again, there's somewhere in between here, but it's coming up to a point where they're going to put it to a vote. And there's a lot of questions about it. In the article I read, the statistics that surround stuff like this always get a little bit questionable to me when they're saying 80% of Coloradoans, is that
Coloradoans?
Coloradoans. Those who live and habitate in Colorado, 80% are in favor of wolf reintroduction. And of course, you have to look at the size of the survey you're looking at. I think it was 700 people that they interviewed.
Yeah.
And then you have to question like the demographics of that group. Did they call did they go around one of the universities and just take a poll and say, hey, do you like wolves? And if you answer yes, we're going to say that, yes, you're in favor of reintroduction.
Yeah,
so
they go around one city, or did they take like a representative group from cross-section from the entire city?
Well, and really, a 700-person survey is not an especially large group anyway. So
This time around, Colorado Parks and Wildlife, they're not taking a stance, but this has actually come up before, back in, I think it was 2016, and at the time, they were actually against it. Because their position is that the wolves are coming back naturally.
Right.
So there's no reason to mess with things.
Well, and frankly, waste taxpayer dollars. I know that came up, that, you know, the notion that you're going to spend all this money on reintroducing wolves, and of course, with the reintroduction of wolves, that comes with paying farmers for any livestock or ranchers for any livestock that are killed. So that's got to be part of the budget. Well, that's coming out of the taxpayer coffers. So why, at a time when, you know, tourism dollars have really been adversely affected with the whole COVID thing, why would you try to initiate something that ultimately is happening on its own?
So another kind of interesting thing that goes along with that, not only is to get reintroduction. So like what happened in Yellowstone is, not only did they have to say that, well, you know, we would compensate ranchers for any livestock that were killed, but they also basically had to make a concession to the ranch community that any wolves that started killing livestock would be killed.
Oh, really?
And so, you know, even though they were endangered.
Sure. But that was part of the agreement at the onset.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Where here, wolves are, in Colorado, are considered endangered. And so they're protected.
Right.
So these These wolves that naturally appear in Colorado are protected from hunting, anything, even if they kill livestock.
Sure.
Where if they go ahead and they do this reintroduction, it's very likely that they're going to then have to kill wolves that depredate
any kind
of livestock. Sure. Exactly. And so you have all these people who are, you know, in favor of wolves and want to protect wolves. What do they want to do? Do they want to have them naturally come back in and they're all protected for a longer period of time?
Or do you want to jump the shark?
And... We want to put 10 out into a valley and then they're fair game.
Right.
If they do anything bad.
Right. Which there's a chance that that'll happen. Right. So really you would think that they would be advocates for letting them come back naturally, setting the stage that way.
You would think if they had kind of a long-term outlook.
Right, but it's all very emotion-based, very immediate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which, like I said, wolves and grizzly bears make people lose their mind.
Well, and that is interesting, too, because I had read about grizzlies in Colorado, and they've been technically extinct from that area for 70-some years, I think. They've been gone since, like, the 50s.
Yeah.
But there's still rumor about, like, well, it's a pretty vast wilderness out there. Yeah. There's a chance, right. You know, that there's a lone grizzly that's still marching around.
Probably not.
there was one bow hunter back in, I think, 79, actually ran into a grizzly after they had already declared them gone from the state. And he ran into this thing and ended up killing it. With
his bow, right?
With his arrow, yeah.
Yeah, I heard about this.
Yeah, and so it's on display. I think they took the pelt and the skull and they put it on display in one of the museums.
I think he was actually black bear hunting.
Oh, really?
And like, Colorado had said, there are no more grizzly bears. So he saw a bear and he killed it.
Oh, the way I had read it, it was like...
You told me there are no more grizzly bears. What do you expect?
The way I have read it was it had attacked him, and then he had killed it, like, hand-to-hand with the arrow. So, I don't know. The truth is probably one of those. Yours sounds a lot more likely.
It's probably one of those mythical, legendary things. Yeah, it's been spun a thousand yards.
I'm thinking yours is probably way more likely that he just, well, you told me there weren't any here. And really, black bears, when they're... There are certain, like, cinnamon-colored black bears.
Yeah, you get a color phase bear.
Yeah, and it's like, they aside from the hump, and that's the size, right? I mean, overall, the grizzly would probably be. But if you don't have
usually, but there are some real tanker bears, black bears out there. Or, you know, a smaller
more grizzly bear. Grizzly.
Man, yeah, those sub-adult grizzlies, they look just like black bears.
Sure.
Just with longer claws.
Longer claws, and they're supposed to have the little hump, I think.
But you know, with the sub-adults, it's less defined.
But, right.
The other thing is... The ears are smaller
and less pointy. I think the black bears are supposed to have a little bit more, like,
they're bigger in comparison to their head.
Yeah, but even so, like, when you don't have anything to compare it to when you're out there,
yeah,
it's kind of like when you shoot a deer and you're like, that thing's a hoss, and you get down there and you go,
that happened to me last year.
Well, me too. I shot an 8-point buck that I thought 8 points. Yeah, she's no, it was not. More than maybe 2-3 years old, tops. Anyway,
50 pounds.
Yeah, totally. A little bigger than that, but still, it was disappointing. I thought it was a decent, but when you don't have anything to compare it to, there's no, there's just no sense of scale.
Well, and also, I mean, if you haven't been looking at both types of bears,
why would you know?
How would you know the difference?
Right.
Like.
Well, and cognitively, when somebody tells you, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, and especially, like, not just somebody, but
the government.
Fish, wildlife, and parks, right?
Yeah, they're telling you they don't exist here. The thought's not even going to cross your mind.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I can't say I blame the guy. But anyway, but I had read a little bit about the grizzlies, and there's no talk of grizzly reintroduction at all, which I don't know that I have strong feelings about either way, but it is interesting to me that there's, like grizzlies too at one time were thriving in Colorado and over time were essentially driven out by people, right? Human population expanding. But why the emphatic infatuation with the wolves in particular? It's just
unusual. Know, that's one. Okay. That's one where I do think it really comes down to people anthropomorphizing and relating to, right? Wolves are social animals. They run in a pack.
Oh, sure.
And they're like, they're dogs.
Yep.
And by and large, they're not dangerous to humans.
True.
Right? Where grizzly bears are these solitary animals.
Yep.
That
They're imposing.
That are,
right?
That are dangerous.
That's, right.
People are scared of them.
Sure.
Right? It's like my favorite story ever from being in the outdoors was from a couple that was scared of grizzly bears and ended up getting, like, attacked by bighorn sheep.
We talked about that one.
Yeah, because they were trying so hard to avoid grizzly bears, they ended up making the same sounds as bighorn sheep sparring.
Yeah.
And so the bighorns up on the ridge were like, I want in on this.
They showed up for Fight Club and found a couple of bewildered hikers. God, I love that story. That's still, like, I wasn't even there, and I could just picture it, too.
Oh, man, it was. But people are grizzly bears scare people. Like, they're infatuated and intrigued with them. But they're more reluctant to invite grizzly bears into their backyard,
right,
than they are wolves.
Right. I get that. That makes more sense. But anyway, as far as dumb ideas go, I think there's dumb ideas to be handed out freely in this situation. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
you have both sides are just so entrenched in their perspective. They're kind of missing the forest for the trees here. It sounds like the wolves are coming back on their own.
Yeah.
If you give it enough time.
Well, and it's one of those things where they're coming back, so why are we going to mess with it?
Fiddle,
yeah. Why can't we just let it be a natural process instead of messing with it and we're going to make it better?
Well, and frankly,
we never screw anything up when we're trying to mess with the natural
with nature
world. You know?
Yeah, because isn't that essentially why the wolves were no longer there in the first place? Was because we showed up and tried to make things better at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's usually how that works. I love those stories about trying to get rid of invasive species by bringing in new invasive species.
Yeah, exactly.
Like kudzu. Well, we have an erosion problem, but you know what'll do great is if we bring in this really super invasive climbing vine.
Yeah.
You and you look in the south, man, it's like over buildings. Forests, it's like you laid a blanket over them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thinking that we tend to collectively maintain is that, well, yeah, so this is on fire, we'll just set this thing on fire to prevent that fire from spreading. That'll fix it. We'll shoot another hole in the boat to let the water out.
So I don't know why they can't just let it be a natural process. And then, I mean, that would be an interesting thing to study.
Sure.
Right? Is how the wolves recolonize an area, you know, a populated area. It's one thing to study wolves like recolonizing a wilderness.
Right.
But then what's that interaction like when they're interfacing with a population center?
Sure.
Versus we're just going to drop some here.
And see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. So I think I agree with you. I think this is a dumb idea. They should just let it happen naturally. And wolves, I think, have a place on the landscape there, I think.
I
think rangers are being ridiculous when they're saying, no, they don't belong in Colorado at all. You know, I think that's silly, but I think it's also silly to just drop some wolves in here when they're going to naturally make it back on their own.
Right.
In short order.
Yep.
I mean, they're sort of there already.
Right. No, I agree. 100%, buddy. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I'm sorry that you didn't get a chance to really duke it out with me over some points.
Yeah.
But next time I'll bring my A game and I'll be more prepared for some verbal sparring.
Yeah, come on. Take a position, man.
Pick a lane.
Stand for your beliefs.
Well, my beliefs on that are just a little fragile, that's all. I don't know that I believe it all that strongly myself. But anyway, this has been a lot of fun, buddy, as always. And let's plan to do it again soon. Mm-hmm.